We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest on Keeping the Faith this afternoon is an undergraduate student at the University of Illinois. His name is Jason February. We're talking to him by phone from his home in Chicago, I believe. Is that right, Jason?
It's in Rockford.
Chicago. Great. Let me read to our listeners the way you opened a column you wrote back on the 3rd of February that was in the Daily Illini. Jason is one of the opinions columnists.
That's right.
He wrote, "Today I decided to look through my fifth grade sister's science textbook. It had been left open on the table, and being a self-professed science nerd, I was curious to see what sort of things she was learning. Let me begin by saying that the elementary school that my sister attends is private, religious, and deeply conservative. Given this, I suppose I should not have been so surprised at the contents of her textbook, which was titled Investigating God's World, written by A. Becca Book Publishing House. But as I glanced over the index, I found myself growing increasingly outraged over the titles of some of the sections. One that actually made me snort out loud was Men Who Saw Dinosaurs. That's right, I'm not making this stuff up. Men Who Saw Dinosaurs. Well, Jason, tell us what kind of reaction you got to your column when you wrote this in the Daily Illini, the newspaper here at the University of Illinois.
Well, first of all, I would just like to thank you for having me on as a guest today.
I'm
really grateful for the opportunity to talk to you, especially so close to Darwin's 201st birthday, which is actually on Friday. So I think this is a pretty appropriate time to be having this conversation.
Well, it is. And actually, this weekend is called Evolution Weekend by some of the religious groups throughout this country of people who are religious and yet accept Darwin's theory as quite plausible and see no conflict with their Jewish or Christian or Muslim beliefs.
Absolutely.
But that's not what you found when you opened this textbook, was it?
Not at all. In terms of the reaction, I was expecting, quite a wide range of reactions from those on both sides of the aisle, both people who, vehemently support evolution and those who take a literal interpretation of Genesis. But actually, the responses that I got were almost overwhelmingly positive, because I think that most people, when they read the column, they understood that, there's a difference between, what they believe necessarily and what should be taught in the science classroom, because what should be taught in the science classroom is, much different than, religion and mythology and history. I mean, I'm not saying that there's not a place for those different topics in the classroom. I think that they can, certainly be taught in the history classroom, because religion is certainly a driving force in history, many of the major events of history. But I just don't see that, it has a real place unless it can be backed up by empirical evidence within the science classroom.
Jason, we're having a little problem with the sound transmission as it's coming here to the studio and then going out on the air. Let me ask you a question first. Can you hear me clearly, or is it the sound slightly garbled?
I can hear you clearly. Is there some trouble with hearing me, though?
There has been a little bit of trouble hearing you, although just in that conversation it might have gotten a little better. Why don't we try to reconnect? I'm going to ask you to hang up, and our engineer will call you right back, and we're going to see if it's a little bit better, if the next line or magic transmission line through the satellites is a bit better. So please hang up, and our engineer will call you soon.
All right, I'll do that.
And for listeners, let me go ahead and say that our guest today, again, is Jason February. He's a undergraduate student, a junior in engineering at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And we're talking about a column he wrote that was titled Religion in the Classroom, private schools still shun Darwin's evolution. And I found it an interesting article and emailed Jason. We've talked a bit, and I thought he'd make it a good guest for our program today, particularly since, as I mentioned, it is Evolution Sunday, Evolution Weekend, really, because there are Jewish rabbis as well as Christian priests and ministers who are using their services this weekend to not condemn Darwin, but celebrate him and his contribution to science and to talk about how the Bible can be interpreted in many ways that do not see a conflict between Darwin's evolutionary ideas for how the world came to be and there being a God who was somehow involved in that process. So we're going to be talking a bit about that. Let me mention, while we're waiting to reconnect with Jason and hopefully with a better sound, mention some news that came out just this week on WILL that I know many listeners are concerned about, and that is the cost-cutting measures that have had to go into effect. And as you've heard, we've basically lost our weather department here because that was one of the places that it was felt that costs we needed to reduce costs. Let me quickly say that this program is not on instead of the weather. I do volunteer my time for this program, and I not only try to interview people, but also set them up and be a producer for the show and find substitutes for times when I'm not here. So for any who might be curious, this show is coming very, very inexpensively for listeners. We do regret the fact that we've lost our weather folks, it looks like. If there are questions, you might want to listen to Focus 580, which is going to be just called Focus, tomorrow morning on Monday at 11, when the general manager of Illinois Public Media, Mark Leonard, will be the guest of David Inge. And Mark will be talking about the budget concerns and the way they forced some very difficult decisions here at WILL. And I will just say, we do have a little readout here. The temperature outside is 29. It's supposed to get down to 13 tonight. Tomorrow, President's Day, cloudy with a 40% chance of snow, high in the mid-20s. I know that's nothing like what you usually get, but that's what we have at this point. Looks like we might have Jason back on the line. Jason, are you there?
I'm back on the line. Hopefully you can hear me a little bit more clearly this time.
It is much better. Thank you so much.
All right, that's excellent. No problem.
All right. So we're talking about the reaction to your column, first of all. And you, how did people respond to you? Of course, many students read the DI and faculty and staff, but did you get any responses, like by email from farther away from campus?
Sure. I actually got about 20 email responses, many of which were sent through the editor for the Daily Illini, because I know my email isn't present in the print version of the paper. So a lot of the people that live in the Champaign-Urbana area who read the Daily Illini, they responded through actual physical letters or through email, and that was all forwarded on to me. And I was really happy with the response, actually. I was geared up for, quite a bit of criticism, because I know it's a very hot-button issue. A lot of people have a lot of strong opinions both ways. But like I said, most of the comments were overwhelmingly positive. There were, of course, a couple of people who said that, they completely disagreed with me, but most of the people that did, did so in a respectful manner, and, that's definitely appreciated.
Well, let's give listeners your position. What did you discover when you read this fifth grade textbook that your younger sister was reading? Now, I take it you did not go to the same school.
No, I didn't go to the elementary school that she went to.
Okay.
I did go to a religious high school, but not the same elementary school. Well, like I said, like you mentioned, I've always really enjoyed science. So I was interested, one day when I went home to see the sort of things that my sister was learning. And as I turned to the page for the chapter for Men Who Saw Dinosaurs, I wanted to see what sort of evidence that the book gave that humans and dinosaurs did coexist, because all of the best evidence that we have now, radiometric dating methods, indicate that dinosaurs went extinct about 70 million years before the first humans. So, there's a huge gap in modern evolutionary theory between what the textbook presented. Unfortunately, the book didn't really give any evidence whatsoever that, any evidence from an empirical or scientific standpoint. The the one piece of evidence that the book gave was actually from more than anything else. The book said that the great fire-breathing dragons of ancient mythology were actually dinosaurs, and it used the battles that, you know, ancient figures such as Beowulf or St. George or Sigurd were said to have fought with dinosaurs, and it said that those creatures were actually not dinosaurs. They didn't breathe fire, but they were actually dragons. And to read this sort of thing from in a science textbook really shocked me, because, you know, that's just not science at all. I think those stories are, you know, plenty interesting. You know, I loved reading Beowulf while I was still in high school, but it's certainly not the type of story that I would have expected to see in a science textbook. And if they are, you know, I think extraordinary claims need to be backed up by extraordinary pieces of evidence. And I don't think that mythology, the piece of mythology that they mentioned, was an extraordinary piece of evidence by any means.
Now, you quote from this textbook, and let me repeat the title for the listeners who may have joined us later. This is a fifth-grade science book. It's titled Investigating God's World, and it's by A. Becka, B-E-K-A, Book Publishing House. You quote this one short paragraph in your Daily Illini article. "The Bible, however, shows us that this is wrong. The very first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, says that God made all the animals on the sixth day of creation. That was the day the dinosaurs came into being. Since God also created man on the same day, people surely must have seen these towering creatures."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the main passages. That's the passage that occurs directly after their explanation of modern evolutionary theory, which I also quoted in the article. They summarize the whole section is about 5 pages, and they only devote about one paragraph to evolution and where dinosaurs fit into evolutionary theory in terms of the Jurassic period and so forth. But that passage comes directly after, and it's followed by about a 3-page rebuttal of evolutionary theory, and it goes on to say, to list a number of key figures in the Bible, such as Adam, Noah, David, and I believe Isaiah, and it said that these 5 figures were the only people in the Bible that actually saw dragons. And, you know, this raised a number of questions in my mind, because, as we know, dragons such as, you know, Diplodocuses and, you know, other huge types of dragons, Stegosauruses, were ginormous creatures. They dominated the planet for millions of years. To say that only 5 people ever witnessed them, I thought that was a bit of a stretch of the imagination for anyone.
So even if you bought their premise that you should interpret that part of the book of Genesis literally, it didn't seem consistent even with the way they were arguing.
No, absolutely. That was one of the points that I tried to make in my article. I generally see people, I think people generally categorize Genesis into one or two different categories. There are those who view Genesis literally and think that it was a chronological history of the creation of the earth 6,000 years ago. And there are also those who see Genesis as a metaphor. For those who see Genesis as a metaphor, that would be more my position. I think that just reinforces my point that it shouldn't be taught in the science classroom, because science really isn't about metaphors. It's about reality and about, you know, observing the natural world around us and making connections and theories about how the world works. So if it's a metaphor, if you think that it's a metaphor, then I don't think that you could reasonably think that it should be taught in a science classroom. If, however, you thought that it was a literal history of the creation of the world, then I would say that the burden, the onus, is on you to go out and to gather evidence and to prove your theory and submit it to a peer-reviewed journal to show what evidence supports that standpoint, because evolution certainly has a wealth of evidence, and if you have any evidence to the contrary, then I think you should let us know. You should, you know, present that evidence rather than trying to slip it into a private school's textbook.
Jason, you mentioned that you did not attend a grade school that was the one your sister attends, which is very conservative and religious, but you did attend a religious high school. Do you mind telling us what religion?
It was Christian high school.
Not Protestant or Catholic?
It was a Protestant high school.
Okay. And was it a shock for you to come from a Protestant Christian high school to then a very secular state university here at the University of Illinois? Have you been here since you were a freshman?
I have been here since I was a freshman. And, I mean, looking back at my high school experience, I really enjoyed high school. I had a positive experience there, and I do think that I learned quite a lot, but hearing some of the lessons that my teachers gave me, especially in science and Bible and social studies, that really made me want to go home and learn about the material more myself, so that I could determine, you know, develop my own opinions and not just follow the ones presented in class, like some sort of, you know, mindless lemming. And so for me, high school was a great experience because it provided me with a sort of intrinsic motivation to learn about science and to learn about history and to learn about, you know, different religions. And I think this sort of motivation is much stronger than the desire to get a good grade on a piece of homework or a test, because I learned because I wanted to learn and I wanted to understand the material. And I think that sort of learning, you know, provides for a much deeper understanding. But to answer your question about coming from a conservative, it was also a very small class size of about 80 students, to a big state university, I really didn't find it to be, you know, too much of a difference, or too difficult of a transition, I should say. You know, many of my friends are still religious. I get along with them fine. I have no problem with that. So I don't think that there was a huge transition, especially because during high school I was involved in a number of activities in the community. So it wasn't as if I was cloistered in my high school and didn't, you know, see the outside world, so to say.
When you came to the university, did you know you were going to be an engineer?
No, I actually started off in business. I suppose it's kind of, you know, defeats the argument that, or the idea that you're born an engineer and that nobody becomes an engineer. Applying to U of I, it was, you know, one of the most difficult decisions for me was actually deciding between business and engineering. Like I said, I've always really liked science, and, you know, I find it fascinating that science is able to tell us more about the world around us, and that engineering is able to put those insights to, you know, practical use. So I've always really liked science and engineering, but I decided to apply to business in the end. And while I loved the College of Business, after about a year, I decided that, you know, it just wasn't right for me. So instead, I switched to material science and engineering. I'm focusing on biomaterials. But since I've already taken a lot of business classes, I'm also going to be doing a minor in business. I have technology and management program, actually. So that first year wasn't completely wasted.
Now, did you have any science courses your first year in business, or have you in the next 2 years in engineering?
Well, I took one science class each semester freshman year, Hidden World of Engineering, and I also took another biology class just because I found them fun, and I, you know, had to fulfill certain gen ed requirements.
And how did the biology class in college here at the University of Illinois differ from the way biology was taught in terms of evolution and the possibility of there being a God, that sort of thing, from your religious high school?
Well, at U of I, my biology class was, it was understandably very different. In my high school, as well as learning about evolution, as well as learning about, you know, kingdom, phylum, class, and the different categories for life, we were also taught about, you know, motivations for certain biological phenomena, why things work the way they do, and a lot of things were tied back to religion, as in, you know, this must happen because God made it that way. At U of I, the two subjects are treated more as, I think Stephen Jay Gould, who is a very famous biologist, put it best, NOMA, which is an acronym for non-overlapping magisterium. In other words, this is an idea that religion and science answer two different types of questions. That, I mean, there's the famous saying that religion tells you how to go to heaven and science tells you how the heavens go. And I think that's how religion is treated at U of I. It's treated as, you know, this is how science works, and you can determine the reasons and the motivations for yourself. So I think that there is a big difference, and I prefer the way it's taught at U of I.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with a student at the University of Illinois, Jason February, who is a junior in engineering after a year, we just heard, in business. Many students change their areas of concentration, of course, during their years here. Let me give the phone numbers because listeners may have comments or questions. Maybe people have read his article. It was in the Daily Illini back on the 3rd of February, or perhaps have just in listening have come up with a question or a comment or something they'd like to add to our discussion. We're always eager to have callers.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from someone.
All right. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. And if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. So perhaps you're listening on the Internet. Anywhere the program is heard in the continental U.S., you may use that toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455, and you'll be on the phone with me, Steve Shoemaker, and Jason February. Jason's last name is spelled F-E-B-E-R-Y, and I should have asked you, Jason, am I pronouncing it correctly?
You are.
Okay, great. Jason, when you came to the university, did your parents, I take it they probably are religious folks, conservative Christians, I'm guessing, since that's where you went to high school and your sister's in grade school, were they concerned about your religious faith as you came to a secular campus?
My parents actually aren't too religious. The reason that my sister and I went to a religious public school is because it has more to do with the quality of public school education in Rockford.
Uh-huh.
Public schools here leave something to be desired. They're just really not too great. So my parents felt as though the education that we received at our private school would be, you know, it would still be better than the public education or the education that we receive at a public school. And one of the things that I do appreciate most from them, they're not particularly religious themselves, but they felt as though they wanted to give me the opportunity to choose whether or not I wanted to be religious rather than forcing, you know, a particular ideology down my throat. And that's one of the things that I respect them for most, because I know a lot of parents, the expectation is for the child to follow the exact same religion as them, and if they don't, then, you know, there's definitely, I think, a look of derision, you know, on the part of the parents. And one thing that, you know, I'm most proud about my parents is that they actually allowed me to make that decision, as well as my sisters, for myself.
And so it was more that they warned you about some of the indoctrination you might be getting on the religious line from your private schools.
Sure. They wanted me to see the argument from both sides. They wanted me to be able to make that decision for myself rather than for them to make it for me.
Well, since you've been so complimentary of your parents, I won't ask if they're in the same room with you while you're talking with me.
No, I told them that they couldn't be in the same room. I might get a little bit too self-conscious.
Let me repeat the phone numbers for listeners who'd like to give us a call. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana and 1-800-222-9455. And I might say quickly that this is the time of year when WILL cuts back on its power by FCC regulations at sundown. That happens in the middle of this program this week and next week still. And so if you suddenly are listening to this program as you're driving or as you're at home and suddenly the sound disappears or drops where you can barely hear it, if you can't solve it by turning up the volume, you can go to your computer and hear this program live at will.illinois.edu. Then you'll be given the choice AM, FM, or TV. Click on AM. And you'll hear this program live. And, of course, if you've missed part of it or would like to go back, it will be archived at that same website within about a week. All of our programs can be found there from the past several years, and that's one of the very handy features that we do have here at WILL. So will.illinois.edu to listen live if you're traveling or if the sound drops precipitously or if you would like to hear earlier programs. Getting back to Jason and your article in the DI, when did you first start writing for publication?
Well, actually, the first time that I've been published is for the Daily Illini. Last semester, I did write a letter to the editor, and so I suppose that would be the first time that I was technically published, but I didn't receive my spot as an opinions columnist until this semester. So in terms of when did I first become published, it wasn't until just a few weeks ago, but I've been writing just for the sake of it, just because I enjoy writing. I've been writing for a long time. And
did you start in high school?
I started, well, actually before that. Huh? I remember writing stories back from when I was 5 or 6, and I actually took a look at some of them just a couple days ago. And, you know, they're not very good, but I think that when you take a look at your writing, I can definitely tell the progression from when I was 5 and 6, you know, to when I was 10 and then when I was 15. So if anyone else is, you know, considering writing, they love writing, then something that I definitely recommend is just to write. If you love writing, write, and that's the only way that you're going to be able to get better.
Well, it'll certainly help you as you end up in some combination, perhaps, of business and engineering. Either of those fields, the ability to express yourself well, is very valuable, and it will certainly help you. And that's one of the things you can get at a good university education. Maybe in engineering you have to struggle a bit to get some liberal arts and literature courses and writing courses, but, boy, it can sure help.
I think there's definitely a stereotype among engineers that we only like numbers and science, and that we don't have any time for writing. And, you know, in my couple of years in the College of Engineering, I think that may be true to an extent, but I think that we've got a bunch of solid writers there, and that, you know, it's a stereotype, but it may not be completely accurate.
Now, in doing just a very little bit of research about you as a columnist and a student and a writer, I see that you've been on the Provost Advisory Board.
That's right. I'm actually chairman of the Provost Advisory Board now. I became a member while I was a sophomore. I was the only sophomore on the board. I was the youngest person on the board. And now I'm the chairman.
Tell our listeners what that board does.
We actually act as a liaison between students and the faculty to advise the provost on, you know, different student initiatives and proposals, how we think they'll affect the student body. I actually met last week with a member of the General Education Board, because the university is considering revamping their general education requirements, and they wanted to hear what students would think about the ideas that are being tossed around.
Now, are there graduate students on the advisory board as well as undergrads?
There are two different boards. There's a graduate advisory board and an undergraduate advisory board, and I'm chairman, obviously, of the undergraduate advisory board. And we're separate. We don't meet with each other, but we do meet with the provost once or twice every semester.
How were you selected to be on the committee?
I was selected to be on the committee based on two or three rounds of interviews. There's always a very solid recruiting class each year, and we're about ready to start recruiting our next year's batch of applicants. And, you know, there's a written application process, and then the people that get past the first round are asked back for interviews. And the interviews, you know, determine things such as fit and, you know, how enthusiastic and how strong a contributing member to the board each applicant would be.
And how who interviews you? Are there students, just the provost, people from university administration?
Normally it's a student that's currently on the board as well as a member of the faculty from the provost office. So I got to, last year was my first year that I was able to interview people. And I think it's nice to be on the other side of the table actually interviewing people rather than it being interviewed yourself. But yeah, I got to meet with a bunch of really, really strong applicants, and we selected several from among those applicants.
And here you are, an engineering student. You're writing for the DI. You're on this committee. Are your parents worried your grades will suffer from all of these extracurricular activities?
My parents are a bit concerned, I think, that I take on too much. But thankfully for my BlackBerry, I'm able to multitask quite well, and I think the best thing is just to maintain a schedule and to set daily goals each day. I mean, the best piece of advice that I was ever given was every morning that you wake up, write down what you want to accomplish that day and do it. And I think that will really help you keep on track. And in terms of all my classes, I'm taking a number of, you know, tough classes this semester. If I didn't have those concrete goals to accomplish every day, then I don't think that I would be, you know, able to manage everything.
And what does your girlfriend think of all this?
Thankfully, I don't have one, so she's not going to have to worry too much about it.
I was worried about you being on this program on Valentine's Day if I was getting you in trouble, but...
don't worry about it. No trouble so far.
Jason, when you first got on the provost committee, were you asked questions about, you know, big topics like what you think of faculty being tenured and things like that, or what kind of questions were you asked?
Sure. Well, our role we kind of have two different roles on the Provost Advisory Board. The first is to act as a sounding board for the administration, and then the other is to act as almost an independent organization to come up with our own proposals regarding, you know, certain issues. And so, yeah, we were definitely asked about some questions like that. And some of the other projects that we worked on included creating a student memorial website for the University of Illinois. I know that a friend of mine passed away. He was a student. He passed away last year, and one of the most difficult things is for friends and the friends of the student and family to communicate. There's not one place that they could go.
Sure.
So one thing that our board worked on last semester was to create a memorial website that was hosted by the Alumni Association. It's almost like a Facebook-type interacting place where friends could post pictures or post messages to the family and just sort of facilitate the communication between grieving friends and grieving family. And that's one of the most successful things that we've worked on. I was really proud of the people on the board, Claire Joseph, who played a large part in making that a reality.
Now, the provost currently is an interim provost. Tell us about that.
Yes, the interim provost is great. I've met with him a couple of times. He seems really enthusiastic about the students and making sure that we get the good quality education that, you know, we came to the university for. I think that we're going through a bit of a tough time now with the current budget cuts, and that's why one of the things we're focusing on this semester is, you know, potential cost savings measures for the university. We're focusing on a number of different proposals, and hopefully those will be successful, because at the end of the day, the University of Illinois needs to focus on its core competency. It needs to focus on what it offers to students, and that's a good quality education. That's what should come first, and that's what we're looking to promote as a board.
When there are students on a committee like this that's advising an administrator at a large university, it's such a huge place, and students may not even hear there is such a board. They may not know what redress they have if they have any problem with a particular faculty member. Faculty members, in one sense, have a lot of power. They can get tenure. They can make a lot of decisions strictly on their own. Even the department chair or dean may not be able to do much about it. On the other hand, students are the consumers. They're the ones the university is for. They're the ones who are, these days, largely paying for the education they're getting here. How do you see that balance of power as a student who's on a board like this?
Well, I think that the scales are certainly tilted in the direction of the faculty. I'm not sure how aware the listeners or you are about the strike by the graduates employee organization last semester, but the graduate student organization didn't feel as though they were being compensated fairly. Their compensation was less than, you know, the living wage, and you know there was a big controversy. They graduate students picketed, and you know they were up in arms about the conditions. And I think, like, looking at the situation as a whole, it certainly seems as though the power is tilted in the direction of the faculty, and I suppose that's understandable because, I mean, there are 40,000 students, 32,000 undergraduates, I believe, but the organization of the undergraduates isn't nearly as strong as the organization of the faculty, and you know, that's one of our goals as a board, to make sure that we give a voice to the students who don't feel as though they have a voice to raise their concerns. It's also a goal of the Illinois Student Senate. I worked on the Illinois Student Senate as a staffer on freshman year, and you know, there's a number of wonderful people working on that organization too. But one of the reasons that I like the Provost Advisory Board is because we get direct contact with the provost, and we get to make a direct impact. And I think that if more people knew about the board, it would be great. One way that we're trying to reach out to students is through mailing lists, and just to make them aware of that the board exists, and if they have complaints, if they have suggestions, that they are more than willing to send them along to us, and we'd be willing to speak with them and have them at our meetings, because we really do want to hear more from not just the members on our board, not just their perspective, but the perspective of, you know, the greater student body.
We're about halfway through, a little bit past halfway through our program of Keeping the Faith this afternoon. Our guest is Jason Feberry, F-E-B-E-R-Y, an opinions columnist for the Daily Illini. We're talking about, initially, his article published on the 3rd of February, Religion in the Classroom, Private Schools Still Shun Darwin's Evolution. And I want to get back to that topic in our second half. Jason, I'm going to ask you in a minute to sort of summarize your conclusions that you came to in that very good article. But before we do that, let me remind listeners, this is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. This is a listener-supported broadcasting service, of course, of the College of Media at Illinois. Listener support has grown more and more important as state funding has been cut drastically, not only for the university, but for many social agencies throughout the state. So far, our legislators have been reluctant to increase taxes significantly enough to make a difference, and that has caused WILL to suffer as well. I commented earlier about the loss of our weather department, and let me say again, Mark Leonard, the general manager of Illinois Public Media, will be the guest on Focus 580 tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. David Inge will be interviewing him about the very difficult choices that the station has had to make based on much reduced funds. This program, however, is rather inexpensive. And so I am going to still be around next week. Our guest coming up on the 21st of February will be Kathleen Dean Moore, M-O-O-R-E, faculty member at Oregon State University. We'll be talking about this general subject of leaving a livable world for the next generation. Professor Moore is the author of several books. Pine Island Paradox was quite well received, and we'll be talking about some of her recent writings as well. On February 28th, Mark Johnson will be our guest. He'll be talking about books worth reading. Mark is the executive director for the United States Fellowship of Reconciliation. He's traveled around the world working for world peace, and his organization has been very instrumental in helping bring people together who were separated for religious or for political reasons. So he'll be suggesting some good books for us February 28th. On March 7th, our guest will be James S. Wolfe. He's a professor in Indianapolis University. He's a professor of religion, and he himself practices seven different religions. So it should be fascinating to talk with him and ask him questions about how one can do that. On coming up later in March, on March 14th, Reverend Cindy Shepherd will be our guest. She's recently back from a trip to Nicaragua. She'll be talking about how fair trade practices can improve lives for many around the world. That'll be March 14th. March 21st, our guests will be three Muslim folks who are helping run the new health center in Champaign-Urbana, supported by the local Muslim community. Irfan Ahmed, who's chair of the board, the medical director, Dr. Shaman Sadia, and the operating manager, a med student in his final year, Syed Hashim. So those are some of the things coming up here on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. My name again is Steve Shoemaker. I'd like to thank Don Nolan for filling in so ably so many times when I've been under the weather. I've recently come back from surgery, and I've been able to manage to get into this program the last 2 weeks. I can sit for about an hour upright, and then I need to change positions and lie down, so I'm afraid I haven't been able to do much more than this, but at least this is something I enjoy and have looked forward to, and I thank my good spouse, Nadja, for getting me here to the station and back, since I'm not allowed to drive quite yet after my knee replacement. But let's get back to our good guest, Jason February, Jr. at the University of Illinois in Engineering. And Jason, in your article about seeing this fifth grade textbook of your sister's and being appalled by what you found there in terms of what it was saying about science, what did you conclude from this? What did you end up saying in your column?
Well, my conclusion in the column was that basically science and religion, they do answer two different questions. And I see that religion and mythology are subjects that answer questions that should be dealt with not in the science classroom, but also in the, you know, but in the history or the social studies classroom. And one of the greatest criticisms about the article was that science today, by many of the great communicators of science, such as Richard Dawkins or Daniel Dennett, one of the criticisms was that people like these have essentially made science their own religion, and that science is going above and beyond, you know, empirical tests regarding the natural world. And I think that this argument is pretty absurd because, you know, for one, I'd like the people that would make that argument to remind me about religion's quantification of angular momentum or how religion explains the physics behind axonal conduction. You know, these mundane questions like these really lie at the heart of science, and they speak of the true quest of the scientific enterprise, which is, how does the world work? Science really is just a method for gaining knowledge about the world. It's a standardized, rigorous, and very conservative method. And there are reasons that we believe in the conclusions of science and reasons we believe in evolution, too. And I think it's those reasons that should be taught in a science classroom. And it seems as though, to me, that religion, especially the message of religion that was promoted in this book by a Beaker Book publishing house, was that you should believe in this because, not because of evidence, but because it was written in a particular holy text. And I really don't think that that line of reasoning holds up under scrutiny. And I think that that's why, you know, it shouldn't be taught in science classes.
We have a caller waiting to join the conversation. A caller from Champaign on line one. Let me give the numbers again for others who'd like to join in. 333-9455 if you're listening in Champaign-Urbana. Otherwise, 1-800-222-9455. Line one, you're on the air with our guest, Jason February. Go ahead.
Hi, Jason. You know, when I read your column, which I thought was great, by the way, I had a question. I hope it's not too personal, but it comes from being a younger sister myself. I just wonder how your sister has responded to your column, and just a few words about that, if you would.
Sure. Well, my sister is in fifth grade, so a lot of the, you know, the pieces of information in the column, I don't think that she, you know, understands fully, like, the implications of, you know, religion and the battle between, you know, creationism and evolution in the science classroom. But I can say that she loved the column. She enjoyed reading it, and I had to explain to her some of the concepts. I do think that she was receptive to some of them. She's a smart girl. She must take after her older brother. but in all seriousness, she enjoyed the column, and I think she's pretty open-minded and understands that, you know, different subjects answer different questions.
Well, it's a wonderful way to set up the dialogue between an older brother and a younger sister, as well as everything else. So thank you.
Thank you very much for the call.
Appreciate the call. Jason, do you have other siblings?
Well, she's not my older sister, but one other sister who's in high school. She's a senior in high school right now. She goes to a public high school, and she likes it there. But But other than that, you know, I only have the two sisters.
Now, was the choice to go to a public high school hers, or did your parents consult with her, or was that their decision?
My older sister wanted, she went to a religious school to begin with, but she didn't like it there mm-hmm. even as much as me, so she decided about herself, and my parents agreed with her that, you know, maybe a public school would be better for her, so that's why she goes there now.
Now, you said when you took science in a religious high school, a conservative Protestant Christian high school in Rockford, you didn't get a sense that there was this much conflict between creationism and science. Did you have religious science teachers who felt that they could believe in a God and also accept evolution?
No, to be honest. It was an evangelical school, and the way that they taught the science was that evolution was fundamentally misguided, that I'm not sure how aware you are, but essentially they broke evolution down into two different categories, microevolution and macroevolution. Microevolution being, you know, small changes within each species, small variations, and macroevolution is, you know, changes in species across species lines. And they said that, well, microevolution does happen. You know, microevolution, an example would be, you know, a dog being a wolf, a Shih Tzu, a Great Dane, and so forth. While that happens, macroevolution doesn't happen. You know, a horse doesn't become a dog and over millions of years. And one of the reasons that they found those two views incompatible was that they only believed that the world was literally 6,000 years old. And, I mean, it's a bit difficult to believe in evolution if you think that it's only had 6,000 years to operate, because the sort of time frames that are required for evolution are, you know, much greater than 6,000 years. There's a 4 billion years that the Earth has been in existence for.
Well, of course, there are millions and millions of Christians and Muslims and Jews who all consider the Hebrew Bible as a sacred holy text, who don't interpret it literally and certainly don't interpret that way of counting the age of the earth. I realize that was common several hundred years ago, but I would say it's very unusual among religious people today.
Well, I would disagree with you on that point, and I looked up some statistics, you know, just in case you brought this up. A CBS poll in 2008, so about 2 years ago, showed that over 50% of the American population does not believe in evolution, actually 51%. And of the people that were surveyed, it was showed that 77% of evangelicals do not believe in evolution, as well as 74% of weekly churchgoers and 64% of conservatives. So I would like to think that most religious people can understand that the story of Genesis is more of a metaphor about the beauty of creation, and that the story of Noah's Ark wasn't literally about a 600-year-old man that gathered two of every species of animal on Earth onto a boat that he built. I mean, I understand that a lot of religious people don't take this literally, but at the same time, I mean, these statistics were, you know, conducted just 2 years ago, and they were also conducted by a Pew Research poll around the world. And I think that of the countries with populations more than 50 million, the only country that ranked below the United States in terms of skepticism of evolution was Turkey. You know, a very religious country is Turkey. So
Muslim, sure.
Yeah, I think that we have a long way to go. And
well, that's certainly true. And, you know, one of the reasons that I felt this program was important to get started 11 years ago when I pitched the idea to WILL was because evangelical Christians, very conservative Christians, seem to have so many loudspeakers, so many ways to get their ideas heard. And the news media so often goes to those folks whenever they want a religious opinion or a Christian opinion, and more progressive, more liberal, more educated Christians often don't get heard. And I felt that in my education, taking courses in religion at the undergraduate and graduate level, you know, there are many people who are thinking religious folks, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, whatever, who accept modern science. And but often that word doesn't get out much. And it's interesting to me that Dean Zimmerman over at in Indiana. I'm blanking on the name of his college right now. It'll come to me in a minute. But who started this Evolution Weekend has gotten hundreds and hundreds of priests and pastors and rabbis who are happy to sign this letter saying we see no conflict with accepting the evolution in terms of our religious beliefs and faiths. So I think there's been a movement recently to try to get that voice heard.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that, you know, there is a dialogue going on, because I think it's an important issue, because it's not really just an issue of science. It's more of an issue of how we see the world, whether we, you know, fundamentally accept science. Because if you think about it, science plays such a huge role in our everyday lives. I mean, we're talking on the phone now because of advances in science. And, you know, a few hundred years ago, that wouldn't be possible. And there just seems to be a fundamental disconnect between the people who, on the one hand, are able to accept science when they're going about their daily activities. They're able to accept science when they get sick. They go to a hospital and they trust in the wisdom of doctors and scientists. But at the same time, they can't accept ideas like global warming, which is really not a difficult concept. You know, carbon dioxide traps heat in the atmosphere, and, you know, global temperatures rise over time and cause and have the potential to cause, you know, climatic events. And religion and other sort of things too, like what we're talking about, evolution. At the heart of the matter, these aren't tremendously difficult issues on their surface. I mean, certainly there are specifics of each issue that get difficult. You know, and they certainly get more challenging. But just the idea that over millions of years that species change because of the idea of natural selection, that only the strongest survive and give birth to the next generation, so that each successive generation is composed through genetics of creatures that are more likely to survive than the previous generation. I mean, that's not too difficult or too radical of a concept to understand, but I think the idea is that many people take religion or take their religious faith so seriously, and they would consider themselves a bad Christian for believing in these scientific theories. They would see it as an abandonment of their faith. I think that's part of the problem.
Can you imagine yourself ever taking a college course in religion?
Well, if I had time, then I would certainly consider it. I'm very interested in religion, and a lot of the studies of religion that I've done, I mean, other than my Bible classes in high school, a lot of it has been independent study. I've read the Bible several times, as well as the Quran, and I haven't read the Quran fully, but the Bhagavad Gita too. And I find, you know, these writings to be very interesting, and I find them to contain, you know, many nuggets of wisdom, you know, many great morals. But at the same time, I also think that, you know, there's plenty of things in there that really shouldn't be taken literally. And then I think there are plenty of questions that aren't answered in the Bible, because, you know, I mean, questions such as, you know, if sin is the natural byproduct of free will, and if there is no sin in heaven, then, you know, doesn't this imply that there's also no free will in heaven? I mean, there are plenty of questions like this that I don't think that religion does answer. And I think that, I mean, it's up to us to think through, you know, these answers ourselves. I think that blind faith is kind of an ironic gift to give back to the creator of human intelligence. And I think that surely if there is a God, then he would, you know, think much more highly of the use of reason rather than, you know, blindfolded fear. So I think that, you know, many of the tough issues that we face, I think that we shouldn't shy away or be afraid from, you know, talking about these, engaging in dialogue. We shouldn't be afraid of questioning. As Albert Einstein once said, you know, the important thing is to never stop questioning. Don't believe anything anyone else has told you unless it agrees with your own wisdom and your own common sense. And I think that one of the problems is that people are too willing to actually take what they've read and take what their holy book tells them rather than thinking it through themselves. And I think that can be rather than, you know, rather dangerous. One example of this that I read the other day, I don't want to take credit for this example because it's certainly not mine. I think Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris, one of the two, wrote this. But they said that, and this is a quote, the President of the United States has claimed, this is talking about George Bush, on more than one occasion to be in dialogue with God. If he said that he was talking to God through a hairdryer, this would precipitate a national emergency. I fail to see how the addition of the hairdryer makes the claim more ridiculous or offensive.
Yeah, some of the new atheist writers, as they're often referred to, are very witty and very bright. But I should just add, Jason, that there are many religious people, including myself, who would agree with many of the things you just said about how important reason is for looking at not only the claims of science, but also the claims of religion. And I would just mention that all those statistics, when the statistics quote interviews with evangelicals or conservatives, you're going to get one answer. You get a very different answer and a very different view of the reasonableness of religion when people are interviewed who don't fit in those categories.
The CBS poll was a blind scientific survey that polled, I think it was 10,000 American households, and then they also did another poll for just the people who responded as and identified themselves as evangelicals. So the number that I came up with that said 51% of people, the American public, does not believe in evolution. That wasn't just based on a sample size of evangelicals. That was based on a representative sample of many different households.
Well, like your parents found out in the Rockford schools, I'm afraid there's a lot of education that still needs to be done at a very elementary level. And I'd point out that not only is science often not taught well in the public schools, religion often isn't taught at all. And so the only religion people are getting often is only introduction to religion is from the loudest, often the narrowest and mean-spirited folks around, sure, which is very unfortunate. But
I do want to be careful to separate these people. Sure. I don't want to cast a wide net over all people that are religious and say that all people, all religious people believe in X, Y, and Z. Because,
sure,
within any religious community or within any community in general, there are a wide range of viewpoints. But I think that the statistics do speak for themselves. They do show that, regardless of which, different community that you're talking to, there is a widespread skepticism of science. And I think that's something that we should be concerned about. Scientists, need to do a better job at communicating science. They can't just spend all their days in a laboratory, but they need to communicate, the beauty of science in a context that's understandable and also very interesting. Because I think that science is it's a very beautiful field. When I look at science, I see an untamed world, a wild world of discovery and hope. And I don't think that anything to be afraid of, and I don't think that science is too complicated. I think that people would really respond to science if it was, explained in a more clear and level-headed manner.
Jason, we're going to have to stop. We're out of time, and let me thank you again for being on the program. We've been speaking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Jason Feberry, F-E-B-E-R-Y, a junior at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, majoring in engineering with a bit of business on the side as well. He's a columnist for the Daily Illini student newspaper. And we've been talking about an article of his that was in the Daily Illini. If you'd like to read it, you can find it online. It came out on the 3rd of February, called Religion in the Classroom.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Great. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with Professor Kathleen Dean Moore from Oregon State University on the topic, Leaving a Livable World for Those Who Come After Us. Mark Johnson will be our guest the following week, February 28th, talking about books worth reading. These are some of the programs coming up ahead. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.